You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
But what about the desert itself? As a biome, I mean, these are species that live on the brink. They live in some of the harshest environments around this planet, whether it's...
What can they teach us?
As Chris mentioned, is really, really noxious. And in fact, it's a complex cocktail. It's not just like, oh, there's this one protein.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
And it's not Gila or Gila or Jyla. It's Gila.
Gila. I think Gila, it's monster. Gila. Yeah.
Gila monster. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So before we get rolling, this was a request from Sam a few months ago. Sorry, Sam. It took us a while. We had a big list to get through and some interviews. But Sam is the member of the Turtle Tortoise Preservation Group. And he sent us an email. Gave us some excellent recommendations, but said, oh, the Gila monster would be awesome. Venomous lizard in the United States. So here we go.
Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, Chris, I can't believe it's taken us this long to get to the Gila monster. Number one, because it's the only venomous lizard in the United States. There are two of them in the world. The other one is the Mexican bearded lizard. But this is the only one in the United States, and that's my home country, your home country. So it is, I can't believe we haven't covered it. And in North America, it's the biggest lizard. So we always like things that have statistics behind them. So yeah, I was just really shocked that we haven't covered the Gila monster. So thank you for the recommendation. And it's just been a super fun week learning all about these creatures. They're so cool. So unique. I was learning about a Gila monster hatchling behavior. Very unique. They can survive on only a few meals a year. Gila monsters have inspired some modern day medicine that all the stars are taking. So you're going to want to stick around and hear all these fun facts about Gila monsters and have a new appreciation for these lizards, because they're really special.
They are gorgeous, and Sam does own them as pets, so be very careful, because we will talk about them being venomous because somebody just died. It's very rare, but owner in Colorado was bitten, and we'll talk a little bit about that. That it is a tough venom. It is a dangerous venom, so you want to be very, very careful. You do not want to pick these up. You know, out in the desert or anything like that. But doing my research, Angie, I did see that stat that, oh, is the only other venomous lizard in the world. But there is one because of emerging research. Do you remember?
Well, I was wondering about the Komodo dragon.
Yes.
We covered them a while ago. That should be, if you haven't already listened to the episode, I'm sure it's a great fun one, because, I mean, Komodo dragons are just amazing. That is an interesting, is it debatable? I mean, they have saliva that can then make the animals that they bite sick, but I don't know if it's necessarily considered a venom or what was, refresh my memory on it's, how that went down.
Yeah, it's not a very noxious venom like this. So they do have little, I think, venom glands, if I remember right. And but it's mainly when they bite the prey. We talked about other ways that the bacteria.
The wound gets in. Yeah, it's like they have a lot of bacteria in their mouth. So the wounds get really in where whatever they bite, they get the wounds get really infected.
Yeah. So it's not like this.
A different mechanism.
Yeah. We're going to talk about how the Gila monster bites and uses their venom because it's really not for prey. It's really for defense. So we're going to talk about that in the second half of the podcast. But before we get there, I just want to say thank you to Mercy and Michael who joined us on Patreon. Again, all of that money is being donated to conservation where, you know, Angie and I are pretty safe in our day jobs. So the funds raised with Patreon, we're sending that off. So thank you for your support and all these organizations. Thank you.
Yeah, and I just want to give a big shout out to Hazel, who gave us a 5-star review on iTunes. So thank you, Hazel, so much. Hazel is requesting the Greenland shark, and we have not covered that. So Hazel, we'll put that down and hopefully get to it in the next couple of months. So if you haven't already, please head over to iTunes or whatever listening platform, Spotify, that you listen to this podcast. Give us 5 stars, subscribe, rate. We love hearing from you, whether it's in our reviews or through social media, All Creatures Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, or emails as well. So please stay in touch. We love interacting with our listeners, and it takes a village. So the more you reach out to us and the more you share this podcast, the better it is for all the creatures, including us.
And just real quick, John, who is out in Kentucky, I will get back to your email. He has some wonderful recommendations for species like armadillo. Why haven't we done armadillo yet?
We did King's Fairy, I believe.
We did. Okay, you're right.
But we haven't done 3-banded, and those are the armadillos I used to work with at the zoo that I love.
Yeah.
Meatball. Yeah. So I would love to cover those. And now that I live in Florida, we have the 9-banded, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. And then he Javan Rhino, and he's helping with Red Wolf conservation. So thank you, John, for what you're doing.
Yeah, that's great.
Woodlands Nature Station. So check them out in Kentucky, and I will get back to you. But no, just this one, Sam, great recommendation. This was a fun species to really look into, and they're a beautiful lizard. The bright colors, Angie, if I saw this, we're going to find out, in the Southwest United States, back kind of near where I lived, I would not pick this up.
I know, but I'd be stunned and blinded by their beauty. I mean, you'll talk about their size, but the Gila monster is a large, stout lizard, and it has a short, fat tail, which comes in really handy with it being a desert creature. We'll talk about that, how it stores fat. And its tail, among other several tricks that it does to live in the desert. When you look at a Gila monster, it has these black and colorful scales. They almost look like beads, if you will. And interestingly enough, their genus name, Hiloderma, comes from Greek meaning studded skin. And that's because the Gila monster has bead-like scales that they don't overlap. They look like almost like little round beads on it. So just really unique from the skin pattern for a lizard. Definitely, they don't look smooth like when I think of like my boys love green and brown anoles here in Florida. They don't seem smooth like that. They're this beaded scale. And then the color, Chris already gave it away a little bit. If you're not familiar with what a Gila monster looks like, definitely check out an image of them on our social media page or on YouTube, because they're a beautiful lizard, very, very colorful. They have black scales as the base, and then a lot of orangish pink, yellow color of spots and stripes that kind of flare all over the body and just make it have this really cool, unique pattern more kind of like stripes on the tail and then splotches or splooches. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. Over the back of the Gila monster in this orange pink color with a yellow hint. And then the head also has this orange pink coloring on it. And then the nose and around the eyes are black. And then the underside of the chin is black and the feet are black. The eye, it has little black beady eyes that I just, I think are adorable because I love lizards. And yeah, it has big claws because as we'll learn when we get to behavior, the Gila monster spends a lot of time underground to beat the heat and then also to nest. And so these heavy claws help them dig in the dirt. So yeah, just a stout lizard. They're not going to win any running awards. They don't move super quick. So you don't have to really worry about that if you bumped into one in the wild. But yeah, their coloring should be a warning sign of, oh, hey, don't eat me. I have venom.
Yes. Tell
the predators out there.
That's why I wouldn't pick it up. And I didn't realize how big they were. I did see one, and I'll talk about that here in a second, recently. And I haven't been back to the U.S. I'll talk about where. But they are big, up to 22 centimeters from their whole tip of the tail, tip of the nose. That's almost 2 feet or 56 centimeters. That's big.
Yeah. Definitely big. It's a chunky monkey. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and the tail's, you know, like you said, fat and kind of long. Weighs up to almost 1.5 pounds, not quite 2 pounds for a lizard, or that's almost up to 800 grams. So this is a big lizard that in the U.S., I could say you're not used to seeing big ones, right? Like big lizards out there. Like
yeah, well, I even read that they can get up to 4 pounds. So, I mean, maybe that's more under human care because
it could be chunkier.
But yeah, at any rate, yeah, it's a good, I mean, it's the largest lizard in North America. So that means something. That holds a lot of weight.
That's native. Now, I know in Florida, get a cold snap. You've got large lizards falling out of trees. Yeah. Don't belong there.
No, iguanas. Another favorite of mine, but they should not be in Florida. No.
No, and then like, you know, I see water dragons in Australia that are pretty big.
What do we have here? I think they're starting to release monitor lizards here as well.
Oh no, oh, that's great. Oh, awesome. So the Gila monster, I did see it in January when I was at Australia Zoo. Mm-hmm. That was Steve Irwin's old zoo and the Irwin's zoo today. And that's where when I was talking to Angie, I was like, oh yeah, they're in Australia, right? She's like, no, Chris, they're in the United States. Cause I didn't do my research yet. And yeah, I didn't realize.
Did I say just like that? I was like, no, Chris. I think I probably did. And I only know that because the Gila monsters, I got to give a shout out to my son's Xander and Zachary, especially Zachary. He loves Gila monsters. And so they're always giving me facts about them. They're super excited that I was covering this species this week. And so sorry if I came off as a know-it-all. No, they don't live there, Chris. Get it together.
Yes, you did correct me. Thank you. And after doing my research, realizing that they were actually in a little bit of the southeastern portion of California, then up a little bit north towards Vegas. But you get a lot of them in southern Nevada, the very southwestern portion of Utah, but Arizona, parts of New Mexico, and then Sonora, Mexico. So that is where they really are found, and desert. You know, it's desert. And
well, that's why it's so much fun. Times. Yeah, it's so much fun preparing their superhero adaptations to live in the desert. I mean, they like extreme weather and they do well in dry, arid areas where there's not a lot of rainfall. There's cactus and rocky slopes and canyon bottoms, and they do great. So I will say that with a caveat, they are considered near threatened by the IUCN. So we'll talk about that too when we get to conservation.
Well, it leads into, you know, why is this an important lizard to care about? Because you know, they are losing their habitat. I'm going to jump into climate change. You sent me an article about that too, about how our deserts are changing. But, you know, as a desert dwelling animal, you know, why even care about him? I know Sam does, you know, so he requested it, but you know, and yeah. Why do your boys care so much? Yeah.
Well, when we look at the Gila monster and their ecosystem role, they play in a huge, important part in their desert and grassland habitats. So the Gila monster is a predator, and we'll talk about what they eat, nutrition, but it's a lot of small rodents, birds, eggs, other lizards, things like that. And because of that, they help keep the rodent populations from being too high. And so they provide a check and balance of basically helping to maintain these fragile ecosystems in the desert. And then the other thing, too, that's really important here in North America is the Gila monsters they're a beautiful lizard. They're very unique and iconic to the American Southwest. And so being one of two or possibly three venomous lizards in the world, people love them. They really capture their imagination, and many Native American cultures in the Southwest of the United States have longstanding spiritual and cultural connections to the Gila monster. So I think it's really important to help preserve the species, to keep these traditions, and to respect the indigenous knowledge about the natural world and their love for these creatures. And then we'll talk about it too when we get to the venom. So fascinating. The Gila monster and their unique physiology with this venom has been studied to make really important medical breakthroughs. It's actually helped to discover and create the diet, the diabetic drug and now weight loss drug, Ozempic. You know, Ozempic. You know, or something like that. I don't know. The commercials are all over the U.S. here, but a diabetes drug to help lose weight and control diabetes. And now they're also using it for just weight loss, and that's why a lot of this it's really expensive. And here in the U.S. still, but a lot of like the stars and people like that are using it as a weight loss drug. So I'll talk about the roots of that, but it's so fascinating that it was actually one of the main molecules in Ozempic, similar to Ozempic and then the GLP-1 mimicking drugs. That's where it came from, is the venom. Yeah. So we'll talk on that, because I had to nerd out about that because I'm super fascinated by how Ozempic. Mm-hmm. I love molecular pathways, especially it's a combination of animals and human medical breakthroughs. Super fascinating. So yeah, I mean, everybody gets excited about Gila monsters when they see them, whether it's at a zoo or when they read about them. Like, I know younger kids love them a lot because they are just so unique. And they're beautiful, a beautiful lizard. So I was really surprised to learn that they are near threatened in the United States. For me, that really makes me want to help save them. And their life cycle, we still don't know a lot about them when they're juveniles. And they think they can take up to 4 years for them to be adults to reproduce. So maturity is really slow for the Gila monster. And so I think we need to even pay closer attention to species like that, where it takes them a long time to reproduce themselves.
No, I mean, definitely a species, you know, really to focus on. And it brought up a lot of things for me when thinking about their desert environment. One of the things I've always mentioned in this podcast, as we look at climate change, how the world is changing, how it's going to change in the next 50 years, you know, not only 10 years, but let's look in the next 50 years. We know this idea of desertification is an issue. Deserts are growing. We know that. Like, I've talked about it. Like, the Sahara is growing every year, and they're really worried about it knocking out millions of acres or hectares of farmland or arable land where people live. So deserts are growing. So that's a concern for all the species living on the edges of the desert. But what about the desert itself? as a biome, I mean, these are species that live on the brink. They live in some of the harshest environments around this planet, whether it's here in the southwestern U.S., the deserts of Australia, go to the Gobi Desert near China, Mongolia, Africa, other parts of the world where you have deserts and there's animals that are just eking out a living. Think about it, like just barely getting enough moisture to survive, just enough plant life to survive. Well, with temperatures increasing, those animals are at risk of extinction. They
exactly. I mean, they're already doing like heroic feats, and we'll talk a lot about that, like what the Gila monster's already doing to survive. So, I can't imagine if it is that much hotter or there's that less water in their habitat.
That's the thing. Even though the deserts are growing, it's the life in the deserts dying. Mm-hmm. And they predict in the next 50 years that you're going to see super and ultra extreme heat in the Middle East and North Africa above 56 degrees Celsius, which is over 130 degrees Fahrenheit. That's insane. And that is going to impact, and let me tell you how, because I never thought of the desert biome itself, but there is a biocrust of the desert, which I never really thought of. I always think of the desert as sand or the sand dunes, but you know, that's not true. You know, I drive out just east of Los Angeles and, you know, yeah, we have scrub brush and Joshua trees and plants that do grow, especially get a little bit of rain, they sprout up. I never thought of the crust or the actual microbes in the soil of the desert, how fragile it is. And if that crust dies, everything dies with it. All that's what we talk about, food webs, up and down the food webs. So scientists are now looking at the impacts of climate change on the biocrust of the desert and all of the rich microorganisms that live in it, like fungi, lichen, moss, algae, other microbes are all playing a role in the desert ecosystem by retaining water. It has nutrients. We know that. You know, you and I know that from all the biochemistry and nutrition stuff that we've dealt with animal nutrition, that the soil plays a key role in supporting plant life, where the herbivores and other animals that eat plants come along, eat that, and then the carnivores eat the herbivores, and it's a cycle of life, right? So when that microbes or things that support plant life die, then the plants die, the herbivores die, the carnivores die, right? Up and down the food web. So that's why it's alarming, and there is research going on in the Gila monster's deserts in the United States where they're studying it. And this was really cool. So researchers out of Northern Arizona University talk about the desert skins disappearing, but this tiny lab is growing plants and growing the skin back and going out and planting it around the desert and trying to not only look at the impacts of climate change, but trying to rehabilitate the biocrust of the desert. So I thought this was really cool because I don't know a lot about the biocrust and that's not my area of research, but what the researchers are saying is they only need small patches because they go out and plant it and it spreads because the organisms in the biocrust are totipotent.
I love that.
Remember that word? Yeah. Remember that word?
A cell that can turn into anything.
Yes, totipotent. Mm-hmm. That's like going back to our early days of cellular biology. So like, know, they're like stem cells. They're not programmed yet, and they can go out and plant these little patches, and then they turn into all the different organisms that they need, and they grow, and they rehabilitate the ecosystem of the desert. So I thought it was interesting. Never really thought about the biocrust. But thankfully, again, the take-home message whenever I talk about these things is there are people out there working hard to combat the changes that we're seeing in their environments, to save these ecosystems, to save these species like the Gila monster, so they have somewhere to live. And exactly. It's always exciting when you do the deep dives and you start understanding, okay, well, this species on the brink or this ecosystem's on the brink, and there are scientists studying this, fighting hard to save these ecosystems and organizations that we cover at the end of every podcast. So anyways, hats off to those researchers at Northern Arizona University and all the others around the world that are working to, you know, not only stop the spread of desertification that we're seeing, but maintaining a healthy ecosystem within our deserts, I think is critical. So something that we can dig a little bit deeper the next time we cover a desert species. But I thought that was exciting that at least somebody's out there looking at this stuff and finding solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of when I was reading all about the Gila monster and some of the different groups at the universities and colleges in southwestern United States is, I mean, there's definitely people wanting to learn more about the Gila monster and wanting to learn more about how to protect where it lives and finding out where they live, right? And so to try to help conserve them. So I felt that there was some rallying support around this really unique creature, which definitely was uplifting.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Now, I'm excited to get to the venom. Got to get through evolution and all the other things before we get there. But let's take a quick break, and then we get back, we'll get through the evolution of the Gila monster and then start breaking down some of their physiology and then talk about why they are one of the most venomous lizards on the earth. So be right back.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
All right, welcome back. Talking about evolution, what I love, it is funny because I think it was Pippa and I were talking about it. We're just on a trip recently, and evolution and reptiles older than dinosaurs. I mean, we all go back to our reptilian brains. This is where we all came from. You know, we came from the seas, then the reptiles. They're so ancient. I love them. They're fun. But you have more than 12,100 species, maybe a little bit more in some counts, but still a lot of them out there. For the Gila monster, the order is Squamata. That's the largest order of reptiles, 10,900 species. Are lizards, snakes, worm-like lizards. The family is Gilodermatidae, and it's the Gila monster and the Mexican beaded lizards.
Mm-hmm.
As Angie said, the genus is Geloderma. So you have the species of Gila monster, then the beaded lizards. So you have the Mexican beaded lizard, the Fuerte beaded lizard, the Guatemalan beaded lizard, and the Chiapan beaded lizard. Oh, it makes me miss Mexican food. Oh, I miss food from home. I love Mexico. I just absolutely love Mexico. One of my favorite places on earth.
It's beautiful, beautiful country. I hope to get John and the kids there soon.
Yeah, I want to go back to Mexico, and just the people are incredible. So we know our reptiles are old, 300 million years. then the lineages split from like the crocodilians, birds, and all of those, and then the lizards and everything that the leptos or morpa. That was like 250 million years ago. Iguanas, their relatives date back 250, 240 million years ago. With the Gila monster family, the oldest fossil we can date back goes back to the Cretaceous period, which is about 150 million years ago. So, long time. I mean, these are species that emerged, survived, survived the fifth mass extinction. Then the Gila monster is actually called a living fossil. Their closest relatives came out in the Oligocene about 30 million years ago. So this is a really old species. This is a species that carved out a niche, has survived through warming and cooling and all the things that go with it. So it would just be tragic if something ever happened to them. I mean, they just, survivors. I mean, reptiles have survived so much.
Yeah, and then that's another reason why to care. They're like dinosaurs. I mean, older than dinosaurs, walking around. So cool.
When you look at them, and like I said, I saw it at Australia Zoo, and I have a picture of it. I remember I sent it to you. I was like, oh, we're going to cover this soon. And you look at them, and they are just ancient. So just respect them. I mean, wow. Don't pick them up, though. Don't. If you see them in the desert, just keep a safe distance. But they won't chase you down. That's one thing.
No, definitely not. You do not have to worry about that.
Yeah. Top speeds, 1.5 miles per hour. That's a little bit over 2 kilometers per hour. So they don't go very fast. They do live pretty long, though. I mean, up to 9 years in the wild, upwards over 20 years under human care.
Yeah, I read 20 to 40, depending on...
Oh, wow, 40. I didn't see that one. Wow.
22, 40, but I mean...
Right. Well, for all those that handle these, you know, it's a long commitment. That's a long pet commitment. Before we get to venom real quick, they don't lose their tails like other lizards. All right. They store a lot of fat. That's what you said. So if they lose their tail, that's it. If it like got a predator, got it or something. But then, I mean, when you look at all the cool features of this animal, you described a lot of it. But before we talk about venom, what are some of the things that they can do to survive in that climate? Like, whenever we think of desert living animals, like, where do they get the moisture? Where do they get the fat? I mean, I know we're talking about their nutrition, but, you know, how do they survive out there?
Well, it's incredible. I mean, that's why I really fell in love with these lizards this week. The venom stuff is super cool. We'll get there in a second too. But just their ability to consume not that much food and very little water only once in a while and be perfectly fine. So, I mean, it's just incredible. So first and foremost, we'll talk about it when we get to nutrition. But Gila monsters, when they do eat, they eat a lot. The Gila monster has the ability to consume about 50% of their body weight at a single feeding when needed, when they're young. So young, 50% of their body weight. And a typical adult Gila monster in one setting can consume about 35%. So when they are eating food, they can eat a lot, and then they store a lot as fat. And primarily that's going to be in their tail. So excess calories will hang out there to basically be stored for when there's lean times in the future. And similarly with water, this is just where it's just so fascinating. Gila monsters can store a lot of water. In fact, about on average, a quarter of their weight. So about 25% of their weight in water alone. And the way that the Gila monster does this is really unique. So scientists have figured out that the Gila monster's bladder actually acts almost like a water tank or a canteen to hold water. And their bladder will get really, really large. And they've done experiments on Gila monsters in the lab. And they found that they can go about
81 days with a full bladder from getting a really big drink, usually after a rainfall. And so they can go 81 days without water with a full bladder. They will start to get lethargic and things like that. And if the bladder is empty, therefore they haven't had a big drink, they can go about 32 days, so a little over a month. So it's an incredible adaptation strategy as far as actually holding on to water, because a lot of reptiles live in the desert as well and utilize, and animals in general, there's mammals that live in the desert, but utilize other strategies. And so it's fascinating that they do this, basically what they call canteen bladder, to be able to when they do come across water, to be able to get a whole bunch of it and then hold on to it, which is also one of the reasons why they can move kind of slow and be kind of heavy, let alone a fat tail, depending on if they've had recent meals. And the Gila monster also has this really cool ability to osmoregulate their blood. And they do that by basically increasing their plasma osmolality. And Chris, do you want to chime in on what that means?
It's biochem. It was like 20 years ago. No, so I think, yeah, it makes sense.
Help a girl out. It's something about solids in the blood.
Yeah. Well, no, you did. I mean, you're the analytical chemist, not me. I just was along for the ride when you were doing your dissertation. I was like, okay, Angie, I trust you. No, I'm thinking, but think about it. You have a species that's desert dwelling. So they're probably pulling water out of their blood to survive, mm-hmm. right? To fuel all their cells. So their blood's probably pretty thick. And that's probably what its ability to do, which is pretty cool. You know, that during times of low water intake, like you said, the canteen's running low, then they can pull it maybe from their blood, you know, before the body starts to shut down.
Yeah, and the other thing that's really unique to the Gila monster compared to other lizards is all creatures, including reptiles, will lose water through their skin. But Gila monsters actually have skin that's leakier than other reptiles. And so that's why it's important that they store the water in the bladder and not in other parts where it'll just evaporate out of their skin. So they're really able to hold on to water longer by keeping it in their bladder and not in other parts of the body closer to the skin surface. But it does, once again, it is like a big canteen. So it does slow them down, which is once again, why if you see them in the wild, I don't think you need to worry about outrunning them. Just don't, as Chris mentioned, don't pick them up and definitely don't let them bite you. But yeah, so it's just so fascinating. There was one researcher that studies Gila monsters and other desert creatures in Arizona. And I love the way they described it. They said that the Gila monster is unlike any other lizard. They come out at night. We'll talk about that in behavior. They have this water reserve, like tortoises do that. So sometimes tortoises do this. And they eat as infrequently as a snake. So it's all these weird strategies from other species that are more commonly seen, but put together in the Gila monster, it all works out. So just very fascinating.
No, I just, you know, like I said, just these animals live on the brink. It's tough. It's like the ones at the poles. So we just talked about lemmings, you know, living at those extremes, and then the desert environments. And so how they survive, it's just, oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. Nature is awesome. It says biology.
It is. And I love doing this podcast because I learn so much each week and I'm always just reinvigorated about why these animals are so cool and that we need to learn more about them. And when I get to reproduction, there's a lot of question marks on how these creatures do what they do. And so it's exciting to me that there's still so much to learn as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like you said, don't pick them up. They do bite. Their venom, it's used for defense. The bite's very strong, and mm-hmm. they may hold on for a while, and it may even chew a little bit, so that venom goes deeper. And when you look at their mouth, you can look at their teeth, you know, their fangs. I mean, just radical looking skull with like shark-like.
Yeah, the skull. I've been getting nerding out even extra these past couple of years in the podcast and looking at the creatures that we cover, their skeleton, assuming they have one. Obviously, some of the invertebrates don't. But yes, skulls tell an incredible story, and the Gila monster does not disappoint with those teeth, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and so it's very rare for them to kill a human. It's almost been 100 years since the last recorded case of somebody dying, but just recently an owner was bit and died within 4 days. Now they think it's probably due to an allergy, had an allergic reaction to the bite. But the owner was in Colorado, had purchased these legally and had them as pets, and he got bit. His partner found him, went to the hospital, and within a few days he died. And again, they think it might have been an allergic reaction, but it's as toxic. Their venom is as toxic as that of a Western Diamondback rattlesnake, and they don't deliver it like a snake. Like you get a little bit of venom when they bite you, but you know, they said they can hold on to a predator for more than 10 minutes and they'll chew, and that delivers more venom. And that's what happened to this owner. The girlfriend found him on the ground. The Gila monster was still attached to his hand. Now both of those, he had two Gila monsters. Both were located to a reptile rescue, you know, after he died. But, you know, one of people said, it's like getting your hand slammed in a car door. That's how painful their bites are and how strong they are. And you've got to be very, very careful around these. That's why you don't want to be picking them up in the desert. Their salivary glands are at the back of the lower jaw. That's where the venom's produced, unlike behind the eyes in the snake.
Right. Yeah. And I couldn't find these statistics about bites in the wild or bites when they are under human care as pets. I did find statistics that between 2000 and 2011, the U.S. Poison Control listed about 105 Gila on human bites.
Oh, wow.
Most were not serious. Less than half required visits to a healthcare facility. Once again, this only goes to 2011, and no deaths occurred. So, and as Chris mentioned, in 100 years, there were no deaths until this recent sad, unfortunate situation. So our thoughts go out to that person and their family. It's just, nobody wants to have a pet and then have that happen. It is, their venom, as Chris mentioned, is really, really noxious. And in fact, it's a complex cocktail. It's not just like, oh, there's this one protein. It's been studied that there's over 12 peptides and other substances that are in the Gila monster's venom. Ones like phospholipase A, proteases that help break down tissues, iguanidase, which lead to edema and swelling, Gila toxin, which is a protein that leads to hypotensive, so low blood pressure. And there's vasoactive intestinal peptides that relaxes muscles and messes up water and electrolyte regulation in the small and large intestines. So just a whole host of peptides and enzymes that can really wreak havoc depending on how much they deliver. And as Chris mentioned, depending on how sensitive a person is to it. So it's definitely something you don't want to mess with. If you do find yourself bit by a Gila monster, experts recommend that you put the lizard on all four, with all 4 feet planted on the ground, and basically pry the jaw off of you by using a really strong stick. So you don't want that grinding, chewing motion, as Chris mentioned, because that's where more of this venom cocktail is delivered, and it can be pretty nasty. So, and what's fascinating is we'll talk about it when we get to nutrition, is it's not really used to hunt prey. The venom mm-hmm. is more used as a self-defense mechanism to other males and, of course, other predators that may come try to attack it. So yes. And then just a little quick side note, because it was just so fascinating, is one of these molecules in the Gila monster's venom was isolated in the early 1990s. And it was basically considered a hormone-like peptide. And they named it Exendin. After several experiments, they realized that this hormone, Exendin, is similar in humans to a hunger-regulating hormone in humans called glucagon-like peptide 1. So that's known as GLP-1. And then several years go by, and the team that isolated this molecule basically, I don't know if they sold the rights, but they licensed it to a biotech company, which started creating synthetic hormones. And the FDA approved in 2005 the first GLP-1 mimicking drug to treat diabetes 2. And then from there, it's morphed into these other GLP-1 drugs, these hormone mimicking drugs, like semaglutide, which is sold under the brand names of Ozempic and Wegovy. And these drugs mimic the effects of this GLP-1 to basically help regulate blood sugar and do other metabolic processes and basically promote rapid weight loss. So yes, it's this insight from one of these molecules that's inside the Gila monster's venom that is basically turning into a multi-billion dollar booming pharmaceutical unicorn, I guess, if you will, for diabetes and weight loss control. So pretty rad stuff. And yeah. So I guess my other thought too is, okay, so why care about the Gila monster? And I mean, theoretically, their venom is a little scary and all of that. But that was just one molecule in the venom. And there's 12 well-recognized ones. And so it just makes me wonder, like, with more studies and things like that, what we can learn if we understand the pathways of exactly how this cocktail is working and what it does to its victim. And then perhaps either use it to save victims or just help people in general. So it's just such a unique creature, Chris. I just, when I found that connection, because I've been reading so much about this Ozempic and Wegovy, and it's so fascinating. Mm-hmm. From you and I, Chris and I are both nutrition nerds and metabolism and all of that. I really want to know how this drug was working, this semaglutide. And truth be told, they don't fully know how this GLP-1 hormone works, but they have some pretty good ideas as far as controlling hunger and helping with blood sugar. So yeah, it's just fascinating. Sorry, I'll get off my nerd box, my nerd soapbox.
Hey, I did tee you up earlier about being an analytical chemist.
This is why this podcast is so fun. This is why creatures are so cool. And
yeah,
I mean, because I learn, I learn so much each week, and I get to share it with all of our listeners. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big nerd, so I do apologize in advance.
But there's so much more out there. Like, there's mm-hmm. millions of species.
Yes.
It's not just 12,000 reptiles. I mean, we got millions of insects, plants.
Yeah.
I mean, there's millions and millions of species. So the biochemical properties that we can cure cancer and cure these diseases that inflict us, but, you know, making the world a better place. Why you're saying that? So don't pick up a Gila monster and have it bite you thinking you're going to get this molecule. No, go through the doctor, because all the other stuff is can make you sick. But thinking about what preys on them. So hawks, owls, birds of prey, are they going to be able to bite it? Probably not. But things like a snake, you know, that's where they can bite and use that venom. If a snake tries to get them, they can turn and bite the snake and envenomate them. Coyotes, you know, other types of predators that might be out there that can mess with them, and they'll bite and latch on, and it's ouchy, it hurts. So leave me alone. You know, don't come after me. So then just really quickly, what they eat. This is you can nerd out on this because just talking about nutrition. Lizards, frogs, carrion, maybe some insects, maybe some small mammals, little mice and things in the desert. You talked about them. I was thinking of a buffet. I'm like, I don't think I could eat half my weight. No way. But yeah, I mean, their nutrition, their diet, and they don't eat very often, right?
No. I mean, some data suggests they maybe only eat 3 times a year, potentially.
Yeah.
So, and that's because it's hard to find prey in this desert-like area, and they do spend a lot of time underground, which I'll talk about here shortly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it's a tough world out there. And so when they do come across an egg nest, they're going to eat as many eggs as possible. Or when mm-hmm. they do come across carrion or newborn bunnies or ground squirrels or whatever, that kind of thing. So, and then I was also reading too that sometimes Gila monsters will even climb tall cactus in search of bird nests. Anything they contain in there. So they are good hunters. It's just there's not as much prey and there's not a regular interval, right? Of eating. So when they do find food, they gorge. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, besides climbing cacti, what else do they do?
They're
the
so
things
cool.
do they do? Yeah, yeah, yeah. What else?
Well,
what else did your kids tell you all about?
They don't, contrary to popular belief, Gila monsters don't jump. So you don't really have to worry about that if you run across one. Now, Gila monsters do spend about 90% of their lives below ground. So this does make them difficult for scientists to study. But we do know that they, once again, use those long claws to dig burrows. And they have been able to radio track Gila monsters. And they've found that they will travel a mile at a time to look for food and or for mates if it's during that time of year. I read that they're mostly nocturnal, which once again makes them pretty unique from a lizard point of view. However, there are above ground sightings during the day. So some research will call a Gila monster a diurnal forager. From a reptile point of view, they are pretty docile. Like they're not trying to attack you or something like that. Or if you're walking by them in the trail, they're not going to lunge at you or anything like that. And in the wintertime, Gila monsters do hibernate, or you'll see the word called brumation around October for several months. And what this hibernation, brumation, I've even read a term called estivate. So it's a way to describe hibernation for reptiles. When the Gila monster is doing this, it basically slows their metabolism down. So it's like a hibernation that we would talk about in mammals, but once again, reptile style. So they do everything a little bit more unique. And this will happen anywhere from October, November, into February or March. And this helps them conserve energy because it's cold out and obviously not hunt, and just kind of slow everything down and store what little water and fat reserves they may have at that point in time. And then, of course, during the spring, summer, they will go down in these burrows or go underground to avoid that really hot sun, right? That's why when it's summertime, that's why they're probably more out in dusk and dawn and in at nighttime because they don't want to be out hunting during the hot desert day. Mm-hmm. Now, in general, Gila monsters are not what we consider a social animal. But what I found so fascinating, this is just why I love doing this podcast, is Gila monsters have been observed congregating in communal areas if it's springtime and mating season. And they typically live by themselves underground with these burrows. But once in a while, it's been reported that a Gila monster will share a burrow with another Gila monster. So we don't really know a lot about that because they're underground and They're really hard to study. So stay tuned, right? That's why this podcast is fun. You know?
I think it's hilarious. Yeah, I could see a bunch of them meeting, having a meet and greet.
Yeah.
But you heal them up,
yeah. Yeah, well, that's the more we study snakes, we're learning about some, I don't know, it's not social in the term that we think of, like mammal social behavior, right? Like mm-hmm. our lions or primates. But yeah, they're definitely learning more about them and the more we observe them, seeing unique things that are making us pause and say, huh, maybe they aren't as solitary as we thought initially, mm-hmm. which is why science and animal behavior is so fun. And as you might already think, Gila monsters don't make a ton of vocalizations. They don't make any monster noises or anything like that. But when they are confronted by a predator, or they're scared or in danger, a Gila monster will open its mouth and make a pretty loud hissing noise. So most likely they'll let you know they're upset before they bite you.
Yeah.
But still don't pick them up. Don't pick them up.
Don't. No.
Don't do it. And I would even argue, I don't think they make very great pets. I know some of our herps out there that love the Gila monsters may disagree. But in general, I just can't recommend a Gila monster as a pet just for the sheer fact that they are venomous and they do require a lot of extra things compared to, like, I don't know, a leopard gecko or something that you can handle and isn't venomous. So
yeah, when you're looking at something for your children, absolutely not.
No. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Well, if you're an educator, we have so many. I mean, I have friends that are herp crazy. Dr. Joe Ricci, amazing. He does rescue, and I know he does a lot of incredible stuff, so I could see it as a teaching animal, but yeah, like for your children.
Yeah, like in an accredited zoo and things like that. Yeah, and you know, rightfully so, there are here in the United States, I can only speak on behalf of the US, but there are certain states where ownership is banned. So you'd have to have special permits. And things things like that. And I definitely, I cannot recommend the Gila monster as a pet whatsoever. I'm more of a bearded dragon or a leopard gecko type lady.
Yeah.
And my kids listen to this, they're gonna be like, what? We're gonna get a bearded dragon? No, they want a bearded dragon so bad. And I'm like, not right now. Do you understand how long they live? Like, are you gonna take this bearded dragon to college? And they're like, yes. And I'm like, yeah, right. So
yeah, right. Yeah.
Stay tuned, everyone out there. Ask me again next year who won the battle. Yeah. I mean, I love bearded dragons. I cared for them when I was a zookeeper, but it was at an accredited zoo. So we had a vet and we had all the accoutrements. Reptiles are hard. I guess that's my message, is a lot of people think like, well, I don't want to get a dog because I don't want to walk it, or I don't want to get a cat because cats are cats. But a reptile, I mean, they may not eat as much and they may not poop as often, or you don't have to take them on walks, but they're so sensitive with their lighting requirements, their heat requirements, depending on their humidity requirements, their specialized foods. They are not for the faint-hearted, and that's even for your easy bearded dragons. I'm on a bearded dragon rehoming website just to look around and see if anybody's giving one away. We're not getting one, kids, but just because and there's so many out there, so many people get them as pets and they're like, oopsie, this is hard to take care of, it's not working, and then they want to get rid of them. So please, anybody who's a pet owner out there, please do your research before you get any pet, whether it's a reptile, a dog, a cat, see if it's a good fit, because there's too many unwanted pets out there, including reptiles. There's so many unwanted bearded dragons right now, just from my little looking on some Facebook groups. So yeah, so just think about that. If you are going to get one, maybe try to rescue one as well. Anyways, that's all. I'm on a lot of soapboxes tonight, Chris. Must be something in my tea.
Well, let's get. You talked about the repro. That's really unique. So, what is very unique about that?
Oh, so fascinating. Yes. So, in general, Gila monsters, they typically mate in May. Anywhere between April and June, male Gila monsters will start competing in wrestling matches that can go on and on for hours. And there will always be a winner and a loser. And the loser usually isn't injured too bad, but he leaves. And then the winner of the battle will typically mate with a female. And so this courtship, which once again usually happens in May in the Southwest here in the United States, begins with the male Gila monster doing some tongue flicking. We didn't even get a chance to talk about this, but of course, lizards can use their tongue flicking as a way to taste or smell the air. And so that way they can see if a female is secreting the right pheromones and where she is in her cycle. And once he does that and he locates a female, the male Gila monster will lie next to her side and rub his chin on her back and her neck. And then he'll hold her with his hind legs. And if the female doesn't like the male, she will try to bite him and get out from underneath him. Good for her. Yes. If she does like him, if she's receptive, she'll raise her tail and they'll do a cloaca kiss, which we've talked about before, which is just basically rubbing the two cloacas together. And with the male moving his tail under the female Gila monsters, it basically brings their vents, their reproductive tracts, into contact. Copulation has been recorded to last anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour.
Well.
And then a female will lay her eggs anywhere from 1 to 12, on average about 4, in July or August. And the female will find a good nest that she'll dig out, and she'll lay these 4 to 12 eggs in leaves underground and never look back. Now, what's so fascinating is for a long time, it was understood that the incubation period for the average Gila monster hatchling was about 10 months. So what they would do is they'd spend the winter underground, incubating, blah, blah. And then when the weather, once it's spring, summer, and there's more food availability and more rain, right, following the rains, that the Gila monster hatchlings would hatch and come out. But not the Gila monster. They do things differently. And it's so fascinating. There was a recent study at Arizona State University by Dale DiNardo and his team that found out that although the eggs were laid in July, actually underground, the Gila monster, the little hatchlings, the little tiny babies, they actually hatch in October. Mm-hmm. And they remain in their nest, just hunkered down underground. And they wait and emerge until conditions are much better, which is about the summertime. And this term is called nest overwintering. And it's not this has never been heard of before. This adaptation of survival has been seen in some cold water turtles, where the hatchlings just hang out for several months at a time because it's not great weather up above. But never before in lizards, and not until recently in Gila monsters. So they didn't know what they were doing underground.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And there's still several questions they have because another really big gaping hole in the Gila monster research is juveniles. So there's just not much known about when these young lizards, when they do hatch, they hang out hunkered underground, and I guess they survive on their nutrients that they developed when they were in the egg. And when they emerge, we just don't know a lot about juveniles. So they're hardly ever spotted in the wild. So chances are, if you come across a Gila monster, it'll be an adult, which is about 4 to 5 years old or older. So these teenage Gila monsters aged, 10 months to 3 years, we don't really know. Yeah. Fascinating. right? But what we do know, once again, with their life cycle is that it takes about 4 to 5 years to reach maturity. And so if there are a couple bad years with droughts or climate change or whatever, that can really do some serious damage on their overall population numbers. Because once again, just because 1 to 12 eggs were hatched, you know, some of them will be able to do this nest overwintering underground. But do all of them make it? I mean, we don't have those statistics. We don't know how many emerge in the following summer. So it's very hard to get a population count of these guys. And we do know that they are, you know, there's a lot of threats, and that's why the IUCN has listed them as near, the Gila monster as near threatened, just because of habitat destruction, urbanization, agricultural development, busy highways, all of that. But the good news is the Gila monster is legally protected in all states in which they are found. So people are fighting for them. People, and once in a while, people will kill them when they come across them in the wild. I see it here. I saw it the other day, a coral snake just, you know, dead on a trail. And I'm, you know, obviously somebody killed it, just because it's a coral snake. And it is venomous, but they're, coral snakes are shy and beautiful, and they're not, you know, so anyways, the IUCN does think that there probably are some that, there is some loss due to, due to people not being educated or being fearful. But in general, it's mostly habitat destruction, urbanization, climate change. And so, and like I said, we still need to learn. There's still a lot we don't know about them. We need to learn more.
Yeah. No, there is. I mean, there is. And like we said, the desert biome is just, it's fragile. It is a fragile, even though it's not growing in the right ways, right? It's dying. And then just dead soil and sand is taking over arable land, which isn't okay. So again, you know, just all of us need to do our part to limit climate change. And, you know, one thing you can do is just help share this story, you know, on social media, wherever you are. You can just say, hey, this was a great podcast on this really fun species. Learn about it. And as we spread education, because that's what Angie and I have been doing for 7-8 years now, just educate. And knowledge is power. So help us do and spread that message. But we love our herpers. Some incredible organizations out there. So many. I know so many. They're so rabid. Like anytime you meet somebody that loves lizards and snakes and everything, they're just rabid. They really do a great job educating the public on these animals. Like you said, a coral snake, leave it alone. It's not going to chase you down. It's not. You know, yeah, it is venomous, but leave them alone and they'll leave you alone. So anyways, who's out there fighting for Gila monsters?
Yeah, Chris. So I want to give a big shout out this week to the Friends of the Saguaro National Park. This organization has an Adopt a Gila Monster program in order to help support conservation efforts for the species. And I really like this group as well because they have something called the Gila Monster Project too, where they are basically asking the public for citizen science and to send them photos of if you are out and about in the area of Saguaro and other, and this is a national park in Arizona, it's part of the National Park Service, or other areas. If you find a Gila monster, take a photo of it, stay away, don't pick it up, as we have talked about. And you can email your photo along with location and date to gilamonsterresearch@gmail.com. And help these researchers learn more about where Gila monsters are found. And this program has been going for a while, since 2008. And they are learning just so much more about how these Gila monsters are living in the wild, their population size, when they're most active, and how they're using the habitat in the park, which also helps give directives of how best to use the space and to protect them. And of course, the data that they're getting can be extrapolated further to other national parks in the Southwest. So check out the Saguaro National Park. They're on Facebook, and their website can be found at www.nps.gov/SAGU/get involved/Gila. That's G-I-A GILA-monster-project. So yeah, it's a pretty fun interactive website, and their Facebook, of course, is pretty active as well because it's the Saguaro National Park. Makes me want to go here.
And then I just want to plug for Sam the TTPG group, Turtle and Tortoise Preservation Group. You can find them at ttpg.org out there. Sam, I know, you know, has a Gila monster. I'm sure he's using it to educate people. Don't pick this up. And, you know, part of the group is really working hard to conserve species, you know, around the world. And I just want to tip my hat to them. Great recommendation, Sam. You know, and anybody else, if you have a recommendation of a species we haven't covered yet, we've had over 400 episodes. I know that's a lot of animals. A lot of those are interviews too. But if you have a species we haven't covered yet, please email us at allcreaturespod@gmail.com and we will add them to the list. We've got, I know, one that somebody on an iTunes 5-star review requested. That's a good way to request a species. Go give us a comment there and a 5-star in your species, and we added that to the list that we'll be covering, I think, next. So we got to have a little discussion on it. But an old ancient lives a long time. So I'll leave it at that. So you can guess what species we're going to cover next. But great job today, Angie. I could tell you were excited about this one.
Yes, Chris, it was a fun podcast. So thank you, everyone, for listening, caring, and sharing. Take care.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats.com and save 15% with promo code DEAL.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.